Mitch Murray.
You won Olympic gold with an ace. How about one more here?
Any point will do.
The waiting is over.
6-4, 7-5, 6-4.
Andy Murray is the Wimbledon champion.
After 79 years, Great Britain on top of the tennis world.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Dugout Debate podcast. This week, we were going to talk about some of the fan trouble in the UK and abroad. However, given that one of the titans of British sport has heavily hinted about his possible retirement, we're going to discuss the one and only Andy Murray. With us is Ed Bowers, founder and creator of the fantastic Education to Sport website and podcast, an invaluable resource for all budding sports scientists and sports students looking for a career in the industry.
Great to be on the show.
How do you do?
Hello.
Of course, we have Jack and Chris ready for another year of fact-filled fun and games. Hello, chaps.
Hello.
Quickly, Ed, if you just take us through your work, please.
Cheers, Tim. Well, you sort of just said it earlier. I have a podcast show which has been running for 3 years, all about how to work in the sports industry, but the different sectors. It's called the Sport Industry Access Podcast, where I interview people around the world with the different career roles. And yeah, as I said earlier, great to be on the show. I do enjoy listening to your podcast, something different, and I'm very much looking forward to this discussion today about Andy Murray.
Yeah, I really do go and have a look at Ed's website. It's fantastic. It has so much depth and sort of really good interviews with lots of interesting people from all around the sports industry, whether or not it's, you know, going down the heavy sort of science route, physiology, all that kind of stuff, to the guys who've been in management. It's excellent. Just go and have a look at it. You might find me on there as well. So, you know, excellent people. Briefly, we're going to take you through Andy Murray. I'm going to give you a very whistle-stop tour, literally bullet points of the stuff that he's done in his career, so just hold on tight. So he turned pro in 2005, and of course in February 2006 he became British number one, overtaking Tim Henman. His first ATP Tour title was the San Jose SAP Open in 2006, and following that he won 39 tour tournaments throughout the rest of his career. In 2007 he became a top 10 player, and his first Grand Slam final was in 2008 in the loss to US Open champion at the time, Roger Federer, and subsequent losses in 2010 and 2011 Australian Open final to Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic. He of course lost the Wimbledon final to Roger Federer. His first win was in London 2012, where he won the Olympic gold medal in the men's singles and then won mixed doubles silver with Laura Robson. Almost immediately following the success was his first Grand Slam win in the 2012 US Open, beating Novak Djokovic in an epic five-setter. And of course, we all remember his 2013 win versus Djokovic in the Scorchron Center Court. In 2015, he made his heroic contribution to the 3-1 Great Britain Davis Cup win versus Belgium. And then in 2016, won Wimbledon again, facing Raonic in the final. He won his second consecutive Olympic gold versus Juan Martín del Potro in 2016, and then in 2016 he also won the ATP Tour World Finals. Unfortunately, hip injuries in subsequent years have attenuated his progress, and it seems retirement may be imminent, or maybe not, judging by his comments in the recent past. So, just as a starter, what do you guys think of Murray now? Where are you sitting with him? Where does he rank in your sporting hierarchy?
I mean, for me personally, he's grown a hell of a lot in my sporting heroes in terms of the list. Originally, when he first came out, I always had the impression that he was a bit arrogant because he was quite quiet, he kept himself to himself. But as his career grew and we grew to enjoy watching him play tennis and enjoy getting to know Andy Murray, I think he grew in my favourites as well. And obviously, him finally getting the Wimbledon title for us as British people, it was massive. And just seeing the adulation and the celebration that he had when he won it was amazing.
Very much so. What about you, Ed?
I totally agree with what Jack said. I think another point I would point out is his style of play. was very attractive to watch, especially against those great players like Federer. When he beat him winning that first gold medal, the belief went straight up. And I think his personality came out even more in 2012, which led to greater things throughout his career. So I've grown on him. I'll be honest, I'm a big Nadal fan. I played a lot of tennis from the age of 7 till 21. So Murray was always in the mix, but from a performance standpoint, it was all about watching Federer and Nadal in those great Wimbledon finals. But when Murray came in the mix, I think he did establish himself, reflecting now, to be honest.
We'll go on to his playing style, actually, just after Chris has thrown his opinion in. But I think that his playing style was a major contributor to how successful he was in relation to the rest of the Big Four. I think if he had sort of a more attacking, flairy style, say like Del Potro or somebody similar, he probably wouldn't have had quite the success he did. Chris, just give us a little roundup of what you think.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Ed that just the fact that he's British, I think, makes a massive difference as to why he's revered just the way he is. Because for a lot of just tennis fans, they will pick a Nadal, a Federer or a Djokovic ahead of him on their tennis sporting heroes. But as Jack was saying before as well, personally grew on me when you got to see more of his personality. Originally, you get to see a bit of his style of play, and yeah, you can get behind that, but he wasn't quite the same guy that a Nadal is, where he's fist pumping every 2 seconds. He grew into that more as his career went on, and that definitely engaged the fans even more. But at the start of his career, as people were always saying, when he lost stuff, he was Scottish, and when he was winning stuff, he was British. And he outgrew that sentiment. That was something I believe that was at the start of his career and doesn't define him anymore.
Absolutely. Just to throw my own coin into the mix, I thought when he was a bit younger, I thought he was quite volatile and standoffish. But I just think that's because we didn't really understand him as a personality. He's extremely erudite and intelligent man, and over time you sort of get to really appreciate his passion and his dry wit and his humour, like the British comment you've just said there, and depending on whether or not he's just won or not. His passion, obviously you can see that on the court when he's playing. I think early on it was quite easy to mix up the passion with sort of, not thuggishness, because that's not really the right word, but
a loss of temper,
but actually it's more a refocusing thing for him, and the ability to move on from one point to another is really important in tennis, I think you can agree. And of course his drive for equality in tennis is another thing that's really endeared him to a lot of people, and particularly in the more recent past, because obviously in 2016 he had a couple of incidents where I think he fought off a journalist after, I think they stated, Sam Querrey was the first American to reach a Grand Slam final since 2009. Yeah. And he was like, well, no, male player, because Serena has won pretty much everything under the sun in that time. And I think then, was it Inverdale who said that Murray was the first person to win two Olympic gold medals in tennis? And he was like, well, to defend it, yeah, maybe. But I think Venus and Serena won about four each. So, you know, another string to his bow. And I think that the sort of his feminist attitude and the drive for equality that he had really endeared him to a lot of people. Obviously, he had Maresmo as his coach. So, yeah, he's a great bloke. But anyway, let's talk about more of the fundamentals of his style of play. Ed, if you were to sum up Andy Murray's style of play in a sentence or two, what would you say it was?
I would say explosive from the back of the court. If I had to sum up it like that, when on the baseline, I would say he's one of the best defenders. You know, against some of the greats, he was just explosive, especially on the inside forehand, for example. He's just phenomenal. And that down the line backhand, actually, as well. So I would say power.
Yeah, it's almost like you've taken it straight from the article that I was reading on it. What it quoted here was a fantastic all-court game with an emphasis on excellent defensive baseline play and outstanding ability to return. Yes, we all knew that. Like the way that he would position himself to try and dominate on the second serve and even on the first serve of his opponents, unless, of course, they're, you know, Raonic. Solid ground strokes with a superb double backhand. I think Tim Henman said he had the best double-handed backhand in the game, and I think met them, whilst that's probably hyperbole, certainly was very good. And also, like you said, Ed, the power, the speed, the ability for him to cover ground and make these outrageous shots that he has no right to get to, I think is fantastic. So guys, how do you think that contributed to him being such an excellent player?
To add to it, he was one of the best tactical tennis players in the league as well. Obviously, playing against the other top three tennis players, he wasn't always going to be the most powerful in terms of how he was playing, but he knew where his strengths were. And his, to add to his defence, like, obviously he was so good in defence, and obviously that comes from him being so tactical. And yeah, just to add to that point,
yeah, he definitely developed his game as the years went by, because I particularly remember watching him when he was younger and he was obsessed by the drop shot, and he would play it all of the wrong times, and you're just thinking, you're such a good player, why are you defining yourself by that one shot just because you really like playing it? And he definitely, from that point, he became this fantastic returner, and he had all of these brilliant battles against all the players we've already mentioned, where it was one absolute physical athlete going against another, where they were pushing themselves to extremes to with ridiculously long rallies and making tennis a sport that we hadn't ever really seen it played like that before, where these guys were going from side to side and playing crazy shots all the time, and the rallies were so long at the back of the court, and that really has defined these guys' career. And I don't think you can look at Andy Murray's career without also including all the guys that he's been in the same generation as.
100%. I think we'll cover that in a bit more detail later. But correct me if I'm wrong, but I do remember sort of, let's call it 2010-ish, 2011-ish, he just, in terms of his size and strength, he really exploded, essentially, from what I can remember. Yeah. He was really quite skinny, just tall chap, and then all of a sudden he became this powerful hulking athlete with massive calves and that sort of thing, allowing him to cover the ground really quickly and to take it into a physical battle with these other elite athletes, which I would actually argue that a lot of the time, if it was if it came down to a physical battle, he would win of the other three, of Nadal, Federer and Djokovic. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I'm gonna just say something here. The one thing I always remember when he was like a puny little player was, after, when he did bulk up, everything was all about the team. And I think this is a really important factor in tennis, where players, yes, they have to do the job on the court, but a lot of it's done behind the scenes. And I think that has another contribution when he took on even Lendl as a coach, who just did those fine tweaking with regards to winning in general and having that belief. But from a physical standpoint, yeah, without a doubt.
I think that was an underhanded backhand and shout out to the sports scientists of the world on my right hand.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it was the time that he went to start training in Miami. I don't know whether that was around 2010, but I always seem to remember seeing stuff on YouTube or documentaries or whatever of him absolutely beasting himself on the courts over in Miami, in between the very short in between the seasons that there is in tennis at the moment, and getting himself in that physical shape then ready to do the stuff all season. But I don't know whether that ultimately has had a detrimental effect, because he's not really given himself any time off over the career that he's had. But it would be interesting to look at the impact maybe that has had on the injuries that he's had over his career.
Sure, it could have had an impact. We'll discuss his hip problems a little bit later. But Chris, what I'm more intrigued by is the fact that 2010, 2011, the probably the most important time of our lives doing our GCSE and A-levels, you decided to watch Murray doing workouts on YouTube.
Mate, what can I say? I'm obsessed by sport. That's why I'm working in sport, and that's why I do this podcast.
So chaps, before, when we were sort of planning this podcast, Jack said to us that he was one of the few wonder kids who actually lived up to the hype in British sport generally. Jack, what did you mean by that?
I mean, especially in tennis, I think when you're watching Wimbledon, they always shout out in terms of the junior tennis players and the kids that are younger who compete in that area, and obviously we get to know them a little bit more. Like, recent ones that I just remember would be like Liam Brody and so on and so forth, and Naomi Watson and, oh sorry, Heather Watson. But for me, Andy kind of stood out as a kid. They kind of bigged him up as someone that had the potential to become this massive, massive sports star. And obviously we'd had very good tennis players for throughout our time of being sports fans. But they kind of said that he had the potential to go to that next level. Andy won the Orange Bowl, which is quite a prestigious tennis trophy, and he's actually won it twice. But he won it at the age of 12 when he was first, when he first won it. And only 9 tennis players have actually won this tennis trophy in the 70 years that it's been going. So Andy kind of stood out from the group, straight away. And I think the press kind of jumped on this as well, and they started to interview him. And there was a few articles that came out with newspapers and stuff saying that, like, just look out for this kid and see where he comes. And I think his characteristic and his persona kind of helped that as well, because I want to say he was quite dry, but he was kept himself very quiet when he first came into it. And I think that made people a little bit more interested in knowing where he was going to go to. And obviously, going from there to where he was then, to becoming a three-time Grand Slam winner, two-time Olympic champion, and number one for, God, was it 35 odd or so weeks? Obviously, he's gone from that area where we have so many fans, players that don't make it to the next level, to someone that did make it to the next level and actually competed right at the top at arguably one of the greatest periods of tennis history.
That was in depth. That was good. Chris, what do you think about his progression from starlet to superstar?
Simo's right. That step up is really, really difficult, and we've seen loads of people be dubbed the next big thing. I remember Dimitrov being talked about as the next Federer. Not that he's not made it into being a very good tennis player, but he isn't the next Federer. Obviously, Murray won the US Open as well in 2004, the junior US Open in 2004.
Yeah.
And that kind of gave him a big rep, and yeah, from then on, he was the person to watch. But yeah, I definitely think, as we were saying before, it is down to a lot of the hard work he put in behind the scenes. So he may have been touted as this potential star in the future, but because of his competitiveness and because of his drive, he was determined to make the most of his talent, and he really did, from what I've seen. He's made the most of what he's got.
So Ed, from having probably the most experience around the table of tennis by quite some margin, what are your opinions about Andy's transition?
I think it's been very gradual, but from a junior perspective, because I've sort of been in that, you know, environment at such a young age, it is seriously tough. Even on my podcast show, I've interviewed three tennis players who were good in their age groups, in their countries. They went pro and they were literally living in suitcases, doing tournament after tournament, getting ranking points. It's extreme. What point I'm trying to make is extremely tough to get to that bracket of top 10 in the world. And I think when you look at Murray's progression, and Jack's absolutely right, I saw some information of a video with the BBC at the age of 14, him being interviewed, being the next top thing. It just adds that pressure for a 14-year-old kid right from the word go. So, And even myself, I think at the age of 16, I realised I knew I wasn't going to make pro. And that's how tough it is, just from a British perspective of getting yourself out there, getting your name out there. But from a global perspective, it's just massive. So in reflection, he's done very well from a career perspective. So I would say gradual. But again, he's having that right team around him at the same time.
Ed, would you say that it was a bold move for him to move to Barcelona as a 15-year-old then, that he wouldn't necessarily have thought that he was guaranteed at making it at that point?
Great question. I would say, at the time, me playing in the UK, the resources weren't the same out in Spain or Barcelona. For example, I started playing tennis at the age of 7 in Mallorca on the clay courts, and the tennis system's totally different. The environment's totally different. So when I was playing in Mallorca, there was a ranking system, but it was not as pressured as the UK system with regards to having a ranking. Like, I had a ranking of like 8.2 or something daft, just from a junior perspective, and you had to win like 7 games to go 0.1 down. So basically, to be a 1.1, this is going back in time, everybody, to be a 1.1, you're perceived as a pro, like a golf pro at a golf club.
Is this in the UK?
UK. So I had my own ranking. So at a junior level, you have your own ranking. The lower you get, the closer you were to being a pro in those other big tournaments. So, but in Spain or Mallorca, from my experience, it's a bit different. So, and there were more academies as well. When I started, there were 3 academies in Mallorca. Again, it's totally different to, sorry to get all in depth here, but it's like America, they have academies, like the Bolotteri Academy. I knew 3 or 4 people my age go straight to the Bolotteri's Academy because it's a different system. They different tournaments, but you can still be professional. So I'm not saying the UK didn't have those resources. It's just a different system.
Exactly.
But now it's changing, looking at the LTA and the fundings they get. But when I was younger, to be fair, you had a better chance of going abroad, checking out their culture. And also trying the different surfaces as well. That's another key factor I learned when I was going on holiday playing tennis.
That is interesting that it was so competitive, because that's something that's labelled at a lot of sports over in the UK, actually. When you look at rugby and football, they say, oh, let the kids just go out and play, because they're always involved in leagues, and that it's pushy parents and pushy coaches, they say, that are kind of holding a lot of those kids back. So maybe that's another factor in tennis.
So is it all about wins then in the UK? Like, you can only really progress if you're constantly winning.
Correct.
Because that sort of stifles the people who are late developers, because I'm assuming it's done by age group, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm going back in time. You had to play somebody similar level to you from a ranking perspective. And you had to play match plays. Like, sorry to go in depth, guys, but my mum actually set up a tennis academy in the UK when I was younger. It's called MM Tennis. And we ended up basically touring to Mallorca and back, doing match plays with different clubs. It is tough. Like, another key factor about tennis, which people forget, is the finance of it. The equipment is so, expensive, not just the rackets, but all the stuff that goes with it. But yeah, it's, looking back, unfortunately, that's how tennis was. But now it has changed. Looking up, doing a bit of research last, couple of days, there's a lot more, as Tim, like you said, people develop at different ages, from a physical standpoint, but also, psychological standpoint as well. Because if you start losing, like I did at the age of 14, it's quite demoralising. And you end up just sort of playing for fun. But if you want to be a pro, you've got to have that mindset that you've got to keep going forward and win to get to where you want to go.
And just to add, was it Dan Evans that came out a few years ago, where he actually took time out of tennis because he financially couldn't keep doing this, where he was literally, as you said, living out of a suitcase.
Yep.
Because he wasn't getting enough money in the major tournaments to actually live off, and he was just like, I'm going to take time away and decide if I'm going to still do it. And then I think he got to the third or fourth round for one of them, and obviously that's where you start making a bit of money, and okay, it helps you, but you need that money if you want to have that team around you as well, or a team that you're then comfortable to work around that actually are there for you constantly. And I think it's just so difficult to get up to that next level because you need that backing as well.
It's almost a self-precipitating cycle downwards, essentially, isn't it? Because if you don't have the money to pay for the team, you'll never break into the top rankings. So you keep not having the team who will help you to push up higher, if you see what I'm saying. So it keeps going and going like that. Anyway, sorry, Ed, I interrupted.
No, all I was going to quickly say is, like, I've got one example that comes to my head. Paul Brighton, he said to me, Ed, I had to do three tournaments to qualify to a big tournament where I get paid. So the three other tournaments were just getting ranking points. So, like golf, where you hit that cut line, then you get paid. In tennis, there's tournaments where you have to get yourself out there, different countries, because you're in that certain league. So in hindsight, it's, I would say, quite ridiculous of how an athlete has to get around the world to compete. But unfortunately, that's the reality of it. And it just shows, reflecting on today's topic with Andy Murray, how great he is, if you know what I mean, of what he has achieved.
I think it's always very easy to sort of forget all this graft and stuff that athletes have put in the past. We sort of see them as the finished article, or approaching the finished article when they burst onto the scene. But like you say, he's got to have gone through and put all these grafts in tournaments and all that sort of thing. Obviously, he was a talented junior and maybe he had his career slightly accelerated by that. But at the same point, this is years and years and years of hard, hard work, 8 hours a day, all day, no weekends, all that sort of stuff. So, kudos to all athletes, let alone just tennis players. But
I guess it's important then to also just to say, put a mention in for Judy Murray at this point, that was probably the factor that kept him going. And I've read somewhere that he had the chance to join Rangers Football Club and play football instead, but it was his mum that kind of said, no, I'd prefer you to go and play tennis because I think you're better at it and that's what you love. So I just wanted to say, the parents often have the say, as I'm sure it was for Ed as well.
Absolutely. And on that note, with the mum side of things, I think that's just as important as well. Having parents, trust me, when I did some match plays, you had parents on the court shouting and all that. It doesn't help, but having a supportive parents is crucial for young athletes. I think it's really underestimated, to be honest, from elite sports perspective.
Especially if they're going to be the ones that are going to be driving you around all these places and spending the money to help you get all of the kit and everything for it. It's their time as well.
Absolutely.
it's a lot of, you know, it can be a hell of a lot of time, especially if you're having to go across the country.
Shout out to the mums and dads. Yep. anyway, we can quickly visit sort of his hip problem, and to sum it up for all the budding sports scientists and physios and whoever's listening, we don't really know what his hip problem is because they've been very coy about it. So I did quite a bit of digging into this, and I promise you there's very little information. But there has been a suggestion that he could be suffering from femoroacetabular impingement, essentially inflammation where the pelvis meets the leg. Okay, fine. You know, that gives you pain while walking, which it fits in line with some of the symptoms that he's been suggesting. You know, in this very recent interview he did, he said he, you know, has pain from day to day, just doing normal things, let alone playing tennis. Alternatively, according to the physio room, he might be suffering from osteoarthritis, labral tears, hip flexor strains, and lots more. And of course, tennis players are susceptible to these hip injuries because the nature of the sport itself means the hip is taken through the extremes of motions, with rapid and explosive changes of direction. It's similar with, you know, squash and that sort of thing, which puts the joints and surrounding soft tissues through high amounts of pressure. Understandably, like I said, there's very little information available about the extent of the issues he had, and I think we'll just keep it to speculation. But I think that since, what was it, mid-2017, early 2017, he's been troubled by this hip injury, and following the surgery at the beginning of 2018, so that was January, I think, wasn't it? We haven't seen much of Murray, and judging by what he said in his most recent interview, which Ed very helpfully pointed out to me just before we started, that he sort of changed his tune a little bit, I think, from when he had the very emotional press conference before the Australian Open, saying that he's got a couple of options on the table. Ed, if you just want to remind us what those were.
Yeah, sure. He's got sort of two options, really, where he can wait for 4 months and sort of prepare for Wimbledon, or he sort of takes the surgery, but it doesn't mean he could come back. So basically, the surgery is like the last solution, and if that really does happen, from listening to his interview, I think he would realize he would have to retire, because the rehab, he doesn't know with the outcome if that's in on that side of things. But yeah, I think it's still out there that he won't retire, but looking at those two options, it's a big choice, to be honest, and we can't answer that, unfortunately, but it's just a big decision for him.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because I personally think that he's never going to reach the level he ever was. So essentially, what is he doing it for? Is he doing it to play at Wimbledon again? Fine. Okay, I understand that. You know, you want to have your swan song in a tournament that you love so much. So I would say I'd delay the surgery a bit, if I'm being honest, because he's not going to make it past the first round of Wimbledon, whether it's this year or next year, is he? In all honesty, maybe the second round. I'm very much a big proponent of, let's make sure your quality of life is good post-sport. And, you know, he's 31, 32 at the moment. I don't want him in a Zimmer frame at 36 for the rest of his life, because he's made the decision to try and play Wimbledon when his body's just not ready for it. What do you think, chaps?
I mean, is he going to have the surgery either way? It's just he's delaying one to play in the Wimbledon this time.
Correct.
So it's I think it's difficult, and obviously it's only going to be Andy that makes this decision, but like it's going to be even more difficult for him to have the surgery, where chances are he's not going to be able to compete anyway after the surgery, because it's so much pressure on your body anyway. If he's able to go to this year's Wimbledon, then I think that's probably the perfect way out for him, because if he then goes and takes a year out, has the surgery, and then he's not even able to get onto the tennis court, it's just preempting and delaying his retirement, and I don't think that would be good for his well-being, because obviously, it's as we can see in the interview that he had last week, it's already having a massive detrimental effect on him mentally, because he doesn't want to do it, but he knows his body can't deal with it anymore. And I think the longer he then has to wait, the worse it could become for him.
I think it's more devastating if he delays it and then can't make it for next year, if you see what I mean, because then he's, you know, made this decision and trying to force his body back into shape. You know, this is kind of a horrible conversation, really, isn't it? Talking about one of the greatest athletes Britain's ever seen. We're just like, maybe he shouldn't have his surgery to save his hip, just do Wimbledon and then stuff it. Because I think what they're looking at doing is resurfacing his hip joint, so putting metal plate over the top of it to try and stop the pain that he's getting from the rubbing. Whether or not that's actually the case, I don't really know. And I know that there have been quite a few good success stories with athletes having had this, but at the same point, you know, we're not going to forget what Murray did in tennis, are we? Because he's done another Wimbledon. Would it be better just to say, you know what, I've done my piece in Wimbledon?
Especially to add that obviously the way that we know Andy Murray likes to play tennis, he's not going to be able to play that way because of this hit. And I think that will really affect him as well.
Yeah, I think the psychological point's the most important one, as you were saying, Simo, that this is what's keeping him going. Him kind of saying, oh, Wimbledon's the target. And I don't know if you guys saw, but he also said after his Australian Open game that he'd hopefully come back and see those guys again. I mean, to say that in his current situation is a complete pipe dream. So I think he's just trying to kind of hold on to the positives as he can go at the minute. Yeah, when he does finally get to that realisation, because everything that I've read about it, as soon as I heard all this stuff, him saying going to Wimbledon, I was thinking straight away, if I was a betting person, I would say that he's not going to make it to Wimbledon. I think that's just something that he's put down as a marker, because he's such a competitive person. That's kind of his next goal that he's going for, and he's not necessarily going to get there.
Ed, you can attest to the fact that I think a big part of elite sport is goal setting and that sort of thing. So, you know, you can clearly see the sports psychologists at work here doing their thing, trying to make sure, have a target, let's go for it hard. If it doesn't happen, then that's fine. We just make a new target, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it's a sad situation for who's an incredible athlete. I'll tell you, actually, my dad was the Nostradamus of the tennis world back in 2017. Just when he started getting this hip injury, he said he's not coming back from this. And I was like, oh, Dad, go away. You know, sports science and physios and surgeons and all that sort of thing. And it looks like he might have been right. It's annoying when the dad's right. But anyway, that's enough of the doom and gloom chat. Let's go on to the conversation about, was he unlucky to be playing such an incredible era of tennis alongside the rest of the big four? Do you think he would have been more successful in another era, or maybe he's just a little bit too old? If he was a bit younger, then he'd have the advantage of taking on the mantle from Djokovic, Nadal and Federer. What do you think, Ed?
Well, if you go before that generation, you had Pete Sampras, Agassi. So it would have been tough competition anyway. So, in my opinion, I think, okay, he could have won more Grand Slams. He was very unlucky not to win one in Australia. But I always like hearing athletes where they say they compete against the best. And if they win, that's a bonus. But yes, you could say if there's no Federer, or the consistency of Federer, I should say, like key, because look at, just really quickly, if you look at like Roddick, for example, he never won a Wimbledon either, you know, from a performance standpoint, because he just kept on losing to Federer. So at the end of the day, Andy Murray has beaten the best. And I think as any athlete, you always want to compete against the best, if that makes sense. And I think tennis were just extremely blessed looking back the last 10 years.
I think that's a good point, Ed. I think actually it might have driven him on to be an even better player than he possibly could have been because of his competitive nature. I think because of the guys he was competing against, he maybe raised himself to a level that he might not have been able to achieve if he wasn't playing in this era. He may well have won some of this stuff anyway in a different era. But yeah, to reach the number of finals he did and to play the number of fantastic Grand Slam games against those guys, he definitely, in my opinion, raised his game because of the guys he knew he had to beat to achieve his dreams.
Okay, so just to summarise, you're saying that he is still an excellent player regardless of the fact that he didn't win all these tournaments and Grand Slams, etc., right?
Correct.
Yeah, okay, yep. So that's what you're saying. Okay, good, because this brings me on to the conversation that was going to be the crux of this podcast, but we're already over half an hour in. Because the reason that I wanted to do this was because Jack said he doesn't think Murray stands along one of the British greats of sport. And I'm like, yes. Yes, he does, for this exact reason. Because he raised his level to a point that probably is unattainable for any mortal humans to be on even a par at any point with the great that is Roger Federer, or the great that is Nadal, and the great that is Djokovic. He didn't win necessarily, but he took these guys to five sets repeatedly. And, you know, there's nothing more great about being British than failing spectacularly at the final hurdle. Jack, fight back, come on.
I feel like I'm going to lose in any aspect of it. I mean, I'm not saying Andy Murray is one of the greatest sportsmen this country has ever made. I'm not going to deny that, especially in terms of tennis. He arguably, in our generation, he is the greatest tennis player we've watched as a British tennis player anyway. But I think it's down to opinion, and that's where it all comes down to. Obviously, I only got into tennis in the last four or five years, or maybe a little bit longer, but my my sport was always rugby and football. So obviously going down to that, like the greatest memory I'm ever going to have, and Chris is probably going to know exactly which one it is 2003 winning the World Cup. So comparing Johnny Wilkinson or Martin Johnson to me compared to Andy Murray is a lot different. Obviously Andy Murray is an unbelievable athlete, a great sportsman, and he's always going to be. But I think it goes down to what you've grown up loving as well. And like, I played rugby since I was 4 years old, so rugby was always going to be the sport that I cherished and I fell in love with. And I look at these sportsmen, these rugby guys, and I'm like, they are genuine heroes to me. Like when we won the World Cup, I remember going down to my local rugby club just to go and see the World Cup, like the William Webb Evers Trophy, just because we'd won it. And obviously, that in itself is a lot different, because in tennis, you don't have a world tournament. Obviously, you've got the Olympics every 4 years and you've got the four major tournaments, the Grand Slams. But winning an actual World Cup, I think there's a stigma, well, not stigma, but there's a thing that because you're looking at the whole world competing in it, it stands out a lot more. And you can't disagree with this, Tim, because if England won the World Cup last year, that would have been the greatest moment you've ever had in your life.
No, I agree. No, I'm not disagreeing with that. I think they, by reducing it to sort of world tournaments and that sort of thing, takes away the magic of what he actually did when he won Wimbledon.
Oh, 100%.
Because I think the nation got off such a high because of that.
Oh, yeah.
The whole of Great Britain, let alone just the Scottish, everyone in Great Britain was high as a kite off that Murray win.
Completely.
And we were loving it, and we had loved it arguably just as much as England winning the World Cup in 2003, which is why I don't accept that you can separate Murray from other great British sporting achievements.
Because I'm not that separating one of it.
I know. Jack, I'm playing devil's advocate. Just to wind you up. I'll let you just cool down for a minute. Ed, what do you think? What's your opinion of Murray in terms of his level among British sporting greats?
Well, firstly, Jack, I have to say that drop goal is my best moment of watching live sports, so I'm not going to deny that without a doubt.
You listen to our greatest sporting moments of all time, and that was my number one, and I fought that to number one. So.
Without a doubt, but I think the key thing with Murray, it relates to one of the first sort of topics, was his personality. When that grew after 2012, winning, to me, it was that gold medal. When I knew he won that gold medal at the Olympics in London, if you know what I mean, beating Federer on the same court, my interest in Murray grew, because I went, hold on, he's done it. You know, okay, it's not Wimbledon yet, but he knows how to win on that court. And then he did it the year after. For me, that was the game changer. You know, what people forget, and this is a key factor, and I was thinking about this today, when you think about the Rugby World Cup, you think of New Zealand. When you think about like winning it, when you think about the Football World Cup, you think of Brazil winning it before they even hit a ball. When Wimbledon starts, the first thing that gets mentioned, which British player is going to win Wimbledon? The pressure from an individual perspective goes right up. So when Murray achieved winning Wimbledon in 2013, it made him a great, because it shows, like Carl Edmund, for example, theoretically could beat Murray with the records of Grand Slams, but he doesn't have that pressure behind him. He's got a mentor with him, meaning Andy Murray, to support him with that guidance, because Murray didn't really have that compared to like Tim Henman. Tim Henman's a great player. I enjoyed watching him when I was a kid. He was my role model as a British player, but at the end of the day, and he made semi-final. So from a moment perspective, without a doubt, you know, Andy Murray's up there with regards to 2012 going into 2013.
That was a very good point, especially as he had just lost to Federer in the Wimbledon final of 2012, didn't he? And then he went to the Olympics and then won it. I'm correct in saying that, aren't I?
Yeah.
So, you know, he'd finally got past that stigma of constantly losing in Grand Slam, or, you know, the Olympics isn't a Grand Slam, but it's more rare than a Grand Slam, so I'm counting it as better. yeah, he had finally got past that, you know, I've got to beat one of these top guys in a major final, and he did. So, you know, the fruit was in the pudding, if you like, and the US Open the following year. So we've already covered some of his favourite moments of his career. Something that's in the intro, and we actually really haven't mentioned it yet, was that Davis Cup victory in 2015, where, let's be honest, he carried the team single-handedly. I know the other guys, they made really good contributions, but Murray was absolutely outstanding. That was probably the peak of his powers. And I think that final point, the final point of the match against Belgium, pretty much sums up Murray as a player more eloquently than I could with words. You know, that that ferociously long rally with Goffin, and then just making these balls that he had no right to get, and then finishing off with that lob over the top of his head and falling on the floor in sort of ecstasy was absolutely unbelievable. Guys, what are your other top Murray moments?
Obviously, winning the two Olympic gold medals was massive. I think, as Ed was saying, I think it's quite difficult compare. I say this, but comparing the first Olympic gold medal to winning Wimbledon, I think I probably do prefer winning Wimbledon for the first time because of the fact that everything was so against him in terms of how long we've been waiting for a winner. But obviously, I think the most impressive thing is winning two Olympic gold medals, because the fact that there's 4 years in between both, and he'd won two of them, and he's the only tennis player to have won two male Olympic gold single medals. But I think that's what's the most impressive, is the fact that he has won two Olympic gold medals, and obviously is the reigning Olympic champion at the moment. Unfortunately, he's not going to get there now, but nobody's going to be at that level for a long, long time again.
I don't know, Murray 2020.
You never know. With the two new
real
hits.
Goal. Maybe he's trying to fool in all his opponents into thinking he won't be back, and he really will be back with two fully metal legs.
wheelchair tennis, it's fine.
Ed, sum up Andy Murray for us.
Well, for me, summing up, reflecting, bearing in mind, as I said to you chaps already, that Nadal was my favourite player when I was younger, but reflecting now, it's an incredible, career, and he's actually done most of the things a player would dream of achieving. I think, I don't know if we mentioned, but he has been number one in the world, and that's key as well. I think it was in 2016, so he can say he has been number one, which is always a key factor for any player who plays tennis. But overall, he can look back and feeling damn proud of what he's achieved, and also, and I don't know if we're going to talk about it, but what he's done off the court as well from a personality standpoint, winning 3 BBC personalities of the year, is some achievement as well. I know he has no control of that, but from a personality point of view, which we talked about right from the start, which people didn't really know him at the beginning, he must have done something right to win those awards as well.
It shows you how revered he was in the British public's eye to win 3 sport personalities. That is incredible. I should have mentioned that. That was silly, Tim. But and that adds further credence to my argument against Jack. Sorry, Jack, you lose. anyway, chaps, I think we'll round it off there. Andy, we hope that you'll make it back for Wimbledon at some point over the next couple of years. But if you don't, your body can't handle it. Don't worry about it. You're still a legend and we still love you. If you want to have a little watch of any of Murray's greatest moments, I have put a few, or I will get Chris to put a few on the website, which I've linked during the research. If you want to read more about what's wrong with Murray's hip, I'll put a couple of links up to the Physio Room and New Scientist. And obviously, we're going to throw up Ed's education support website online, and please do check it out. It is absolutely fantastic. Anyway, thank you, chaps, for that conversation. It was really good.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, chaps. Bye.